often a little digging suggests they are not. Lotion McLean said, "Of course, the problem is that there are dead cats flung on to the table every so often. Take Johnson desperately trying to deflect from Partygate scrutiny by repeating a discredited claim linking Keir Starmer to Jimmy Savile. A healthy dose of cynicism and critical thinking never goes amiss when analyzing the political landscape, but this rising tendency of fearful mistrust paired with alternative, often ill-informed explanations concerns me." McLean added, "If you are politically homeless, a term we despise but is increasingly used, then anything goes. Partly, membership can be grounding, fostering connections and communities and orienting people towards shared political goals. Research suggests that partisanship limits exactly which conspirational narratives are to be believed. What then happens when traditional alignments are replaced with political identities that are issue-based? Add in a shocking lack of political education, a climate of fear stoked by media and politicians alike, and the disappearance of independent local media, and you can see how many of the public have now been left to cobble together their own hodgepodge understanding of the inner workings of the institutions that govern their lives. The results are a suitably misashamed and jaded interpretation of events." Why does this matter? Because the stronger the tendency towards conspirational accounts of everything, the more likely a worsening of the social ills that cause disaffection in the first place. Political distrust and conspirational thinking lead to nihilism and apathy. Successive studies have found that full-blown conspirational beliefs positively correlate with political disengagement, more belligerent attitudes to human rights and civil liberties, and less civic participation, such as voting, donating, and volunteering. Even diluted conspirational thinking has a negative impact. Repeatedly, it's shown that those who are less trusting are more disconnected from politics, the news around them, and general society. Lotion McLean wrote, "I have seen firsthand how a loss of faith saps energy and produces a bitter political indifference. Clearly, simply entreating people to realign with concrete political organizations isn't the solution to restore trust or how democracy works. Hoping that national politics will clean itself up on its own doesn't seem likely either. One more. The answer is probably frustratingly pick and mix. Political education, reminding yourself that sometimes incompetence is a more likely explanation than some clever scheme, getting involved locally with a cause that channels vague resentment into positive politics, a multi-pronged approach." McLean concluded, "Conspirational thinking is easy enough to understand, but we need to resist inventing shadowy new monsters to slay. The ones we already have are dangerous enough."
Sweden, a major arms exporter.
I call upon you, Desmond Tutu, to come to the rostrum and receive the Nobel Peace Prize for 1984 with a gold medal and a diploma.
It was less than 2 years after the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to Desmond Tutu, a hero of the South African anti-apartheid movement, when one of the movement's supporters was shot dead on a cold winter night. The Kingdom of Sweden is the fourth European country that prides itself for its beautiful nature, snowy winters, and reindeers. But this lost paradise has another face. Sweden is the birthplace of the inventor of dynamite. Alfred Nobel was a Swedish chemist and gunsmith. After several experiments, Nobel discovered that if nitroglycerin was absorbed by a neutral substance, such as diatomaceous earth or diatomite, it would be safer and easier to handle than pure gunpowder or nitroglycerin. He called it dynamite. The new world needed explosions for development, and this brought about enormous wealth for Nobel. Dynamite soon became popular, and due to high demand, dynamite factories were set up one after another in different parts of the world. Although Nobel made a fortune by making and selling dynamite and other explosives he had invented, this pioneering in the business of explosion and death did not bring him good fame. One day, while having breakfast during his trip to Paris, cold sweat ran down Alfred's body when he saw a headline in a newspaper that read, "The Death of the Death Merchant." But the French newspaper was wrong. They had mistaken Alfred's brother Ludwig for him. However, in this mistake lay the reality of hatred for the inventor of dynamite. Thus, Nobel did not want to go down in history as the merchant of death. Alfred became obsessed with this issue. Until November 27, 1895, when at the Norwegian-Swedish Club, he unveiled his solution to get rid of public hatred. Nobel had made his mind. In his last will and testament, he devoted a large portion of his fortune to an award that was to be given to prominent figures in science, literature, and world peace, regardless of their nationality. It was called the Nobel Prize. Swedish people and politicians have always tried to preserve Nobel's peaceful legacy after his death, especially in the turbulent 20th century. They maintained their neutrality in both the First and Second World Wars.
Before the Nazis struck.
and even remained neutral during the Cold War. But there was violence and terror under the skin of this peaceful facade. No one would have thought that in 1986, Olof Palme, the then Swedish Prime Minister, would fall victim to the violence that Alfred Nobel tried to prevent by universalizing his Peace Prize. The assassination of Sweden's Prime Minister was difficult for the people of this country and shocking for the people of the world. Sweden, a peaceful country, had faced a new challenge: terror and violence. On September 11, 2003, Anna Lindh, Sweden's then foreign minister and social democratic politician, was stabbed to death by an assailant while shopping in downtown Stockholm along with a close friend. She died in hospital a few hours later. No one would have thought this would unleash a domino effect of violence and terror in Sweden. The resemblance of this murder to that of Olof Palme was controversial. Many had come to believe that the door to violence had been opened in Sweden. This level of atrocity was a shadow of the violence that Swedish weapons had inflicted outside the country. It seemed like the spilt blood had returned to exact revenge. It may seem hard to believe, but Sweden is among the world's top arms exporters. In 2017 alone, Sweden earned 3.5 billion euros from arms sales. Though it tries to show itself as a pacifist country, according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, Sweden is in fact a major arms exporter. It's as if this country is pretending to be what it's not. They sell weapons to countries that kill innocent people.
One day they say you have to be my wife by force, like they do raping and all this time. But I talked to them.
Despite Sweden's claim to pacifism, the country's wealthy companies, such as Lundin Energy, play an effective role in organized genocide in developing countries for their own economic gain.
I was 17 when the war broke out in my place I was. So I saw a horrible situation when we got a news that the village is going to be attacked by a militia.
They made a deal with militants to secure an oil-rich region. In return, the militants set fire to people's houses, raped and killed women, and forced people to become displaced.
I saw my people dying, children and women.
Meanwhile, Borg Ekholm, the CEO of the Swedish company Ericsson, recently admitted that the telecommunications giant had given money to ISIS as a bribe, and that all the money had been spent on terrorist activities in Iraq.
Hate crimes in Sweden have seen a record rise, with cases jumping 14%.
The violence that quietly permeated the land of reindeers now wanted to make its presence public. Statistics show violence is on the rise in Sweden at an alarming rate. Research suggests that Swedish society is being affected by a social epidemic of violence, and that armed crime is spreading like a contagious disease. As a result, in addition to social initiatives, the police of this country have resorted to a series of repressive measures to de-escalate the situation. Dozens of graves in a cemetery south of Stockholm belong to the victims of armed conflict. Half of the mothers sitting in this picture in front of the Swedish Interior Minister lost their children to violence. A young immigrant asks Sweden's Social Democratic Interior Minister, Michael Damber, "Have you ever seen so many mothers whose children have been killed?" Organized kidnapping is also on the Swedish government's agenda. The government of Sweden denies claims that Swedish social service agencies kidnap Muslim children. This is while many immigrant families have held campaigns under the title of "Stop Kidnapping Our Children." These families say Sweden's Social Security Agency takes away their children from them because it claims the children's parents are unsuitable. Many Muslim families in Sweden have filed complaints against this agency. The families call this act of forced child-parent separation some sort of legal kidnapping. It is not without reason that Bild, the most widely circulated media outlet in Germany and the European Union, cites a wave of armed killings in Sweden in an article entitled "Sweden is the most dangerous country in Europe." It places the country at the top of Europe's gang crime list. In 2020, 124 deadly violence cases were confirmed in Sweden. The average lethal violence in the last 10 years was 100 cases per year. This growing trend of crime in a European country claiming to be peaceful is not normal. The Swedish government's inability to manage the situation is such that half of Swedes have lost faith in their country's criminal justice system. This is according to a survey by the Office for Crime Prevention, which is affiliated with the Swedish Ministry of Justice. Despite this, for politicians, it's business as usual. They hold the Nobel Peace Prize event every year with confidence. Former Myanmar Prime Minister Aung San Suu Kyi, who not only did not condemn the organized genocide of Rohingya Muslims in her country, but rather defended such crimes in the International Court of Justice.
Mr. President, the court has been asked to apply the 1948 Genocide Convention, one of the most fundamental...
Barack Obama, who Trump calls the founder of ISIS in the Middle East.
They've created ISIS. Hillary Clinton created ISIS with Obama.
Shimon Peres, the prime minister of a regime that constantly commits war crimes against the Palestinians. And last but not least, Menachem Begin, the former Israeli prime minister, who in an interview with the New York Times reporter Oriana Fallaci officially introduced himself as a former terrorist. All of these mentioned names were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. In line with its pacifist claims, Sweden passed laws that allowed it to deal with international crimes, such as war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity, regardless of where they were committed. These laws gave the Swedish government vast powers to prosecute people from all over the world. However, in 2002, when peace activists filed a complaint with the Swedish police against then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon for crimes against humanity, they soon realized that the prosecutor had stopped his investigation.
Some say 900 Palestinians died, some more than 2,000. No one knows.
The prosecutor's office refused to send a judicial team to Israel, claiming the probe was impossible. Perhaps the prosecutor was afraid that Zionist groups would do the same to the fact-finding committee as they did to Forky Bernadotte. Forky Bernadotte was a Swedish diplomat. He went to Israel to investigate the Arab-Jewish conflict, but was assassinated by Israeli extremist groups.
I think I have the right to believe that we sooner or later...
It seems Sweden's claim to peace sometimes fails in the interest of Swedish politicians, despite the high costs they incur for Swedish taxpayers. The Swedish prosecutor's office failed in the case of Ariel Sharon. Instead, Swedish police, in a joint operation with the CIA, arrested Julian Assange on charges of moral misconduct. Julian Assange was the one who published the documents of the US killing of civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq by launching the whistleblower website WikiLeaks. Earlier, Swedish authorities arbitrarily detained two Egyptian nationals, Mohammed al-Zairi and Ahmed Ajiza. They handed over these two men to US intelligence agents at Stockholm's Bromma Airport. CIA agents were waiting for them in a CIA Gulfstream jet, numbered N379P. It's absolutely clear that Sweden has practically become a cog in the conspiracy and intelligence machine of the CIA against independent countries. In this regard, UN committees accused Sweden of violating human rights treaties and the Convention Against Torture. This Swedish setup does not end here. Some members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terrorist organization and anti-Iran opposition abroad, through colluding with the Swedish prosecutor's office, have been able to play out a pre-designed and imaginary scenario. The members of the MKO, who easily hold a rally in front of the courthouse with the support of the Swedish police, are considered by the Iranian people as a terrorist and dangerous cult. They started a street war in Iran four decades ago. Masoud Rajavi and the leaders of this terrorist cult resorted to torture and organized assassinations when they failed in their riotous scheme. The MKO even went as far as assassinating the president, the prime minister, the head of Iran's Supreme Court, and more than 70 members of the Iranian parliament. The assassination of a legitimate prime minister is not a strange thing to the Swedish people. The murderers of Olof Palme were never found, and the case was closed. This is while those who assassinated the president and prime minister of Iran have openly confessed to their crimes, yet live freely in Sweden. In addition to the widespread assassinations of government officials, the MKO terrorists also commit child murder, carry out blind street assassinations, bury their opponents alive, engage in organized torture of ordinary people, and ultimately kill 17,000 innocent Iranians. They were close friends of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein set up Camp Ashraf for the group in Iraq so that members of the cult would continue their terrorist activities from there. The MKO stopped short of no crimes, and they helped Saddam in his massacre of the people of the city of Basra and the Kurdish people of Iraq. Interestingly, this terrorist cult, which has the blood of the Iraqi and Iranian people on its hands, currently continues its terrorist activities in Albania with the support of Saudi Arabia, the United States, and some European countries. Despite its legal capacity in the European Union, Sweden is now a tool in the hands of a well-known terrorist group, a group that even the Swedish prosecutor acknowledged to be a terrorist entity in his initial speech at the court. Nevertheless, the trial continues on the basis of a fictional show and mass collusion, and the Swedish court has become the venue for a pre-designed scenario. The question is, for the sake of what organization is the Swedish prosecutor squandering such a huge sum of money at the expense of the Swedish taxpayer? If you think the MKO is the only terrorist group present in Sweden, think again.
من حبیب فرج‌الله چاپ مسئول گروه و تشکیلات.
This man, Habib Asivat, an official employee of the Swedish government, is another terrorist. He is currently on trial in Iran after being arrested for assassinating Iranian people, but his colleagues still live in Sweden. Under the name of Al-Nidal Al-Ahwaziyya movement, they are still plotting terrorist acts against the Iranian people. The story of terrorist groups based in Sweden is not limited to the MKO and Al-Nidal Al-Ahwaziyya. There are other dangerous groups in this country too. ISIS has been defeated in the Middle East, but its Swedish members are back home.
Welcome back to the program. Swedish police have set up a special task force to combat gangs following a wave of violence in.
The people of Sweden and some of the country's political parties have now realized that the policy of harboring murderers and violent groups has not only not brought credibility for Sweden, but also it has come at a heavy cost, including the atmosphere of terror and murder in Swedish society. Many are asking this question today. Isn't it time the rulers of Sweden admitted the failure of this policy? A member of the Swedish Parliament, who was previously one of the children left behind as a result of the ideological divorces at Camp Ashraf, criticized the former Swedish Prime Minister for meeting with the leader of the MKO. He asked the former Prime Minister, "How much did you get paid to lend yourself as an extra to a terrorist group?" Once known as the land of peace, Sweden has today become a hotbed of a host of terrorist and criminal groups. Not a week goes by that the media doesn't report a shooting incident. The question is, what would Alfred Nobel think of Sweden's name and symbol if he were here today? This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Needless to say, the U.S. government has killed many people in its military interventions abroad, most recently in West Asia and Africa. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Laurie Calhoun, writer. This article is published under the heading America's Exceptional Amnesia. Here's the story. Needless to say, the U.S. government has killed many people in its military interventions abroad, most recently in West Asia and Africa. Yet Americans are often hesitant to apply the label war criminal even to figures such as George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, whose global so-called war on terror has sowed massive destruction, death, and misery, adversely affecting millions of persons for more than 20 years. Nor do people generally regard affable Barack Obama as a war criminal, despite the considerable harm to civilians unleashed by his ill-advised war on Libya. Drone warrior Obama also undertook a concerted campaign to kill rather than capture terror suspects in countries such as Pakistan, with which the United States was not at war, and he armed radical rebel forces in Syria, which exacerbated the conflict already underway, resulting in the death of even more civilians. Obama's material and logistical support for the Saudi war against Yemen gave rise to a full-fledged humanitarian crisis, with disease and starvation ravaging the population. Moving a bit farther back in time, U.S. citizens and their sympathizers abroad typically do not affix the label war criminal to Bill Clinton either, despite the fact that his 1999 bombing of Kosovo appears to have been motivated in part to distract attention from his domestic scandal at the time. The moment Clinton began dropping bombs on Kosovo, the press, in a show of patriotic solidarity, abruptly switched its attention from the notorious blue dress to the war in progress. Throughout his presidency, Clinton not only bombed, but also imposed severe sanctions on Iraq, as a result of which hundreds of thousands of civilians died of preventable diseases. Despite knowing about at least some of the atrocities committed in their name by the U.S. government, including torture, summary execution, maiming, the provision of weapons to murderers, sanctions, preventing access to medication and food, etc., many Americans have no difficulty identifying other world leaders as a war criminal, while simultaneously withholding that label from their own leaders. Viewed from a broader historical perspective, none of this may seem new. During wartime, much of the populace dutifully parrots pundits and politicians in denouncing the foreign leaders with whom they disagree as criminals, while supporting the military initiatives of their own leaders, no matter what they do. In the use of the term of derogation war criminal, then, no more than a reflection of the tribe to which one subscribes, all wars result in avoidable harms to innocent, non-threatening people, death and maiming, the destruction of property, impoverishment, psychological trauma, and diminished quality of life for those lucky enough to survive. Given these harsh realities, some critics maintain that all war is immoral. But morality and legality are not one and the same, for crimes violate written laws. We know that the U.S. 2003 invasion of Iraq was illegal according to the letter of the law, not only because former U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan plainly stated that it was, but also because the U.S. government drafted a war resolution only to withdraw it when it emerged that they did not have enough support to secure the needed U.N. approval. If U.S. leaders had believed that the invasion was completely legitimate according to the terms of the U.N. Charter, then they would have felt no need to draft a resolution in justifying it. Ex post facto, when it emerged that the alleged WMD serving as one of the primary pretexts for the war were nowhere to be found, the U.S. government claimed that the 2003 invasion of Iraq was simply a continuation of the 1991 Persian Gulf War, which had received the support of the United Nations, or was justified because Saddam Hussein allegedly tried to assassinate George H.W. Bush in 1993, or because previous UN resolutions relating to the disarmament of Iraq and the elimination of its biological and chemical warfare capacity implied that military force would be permissible in the event of Saddam Hussein's non-compliance. On the propaganda front, the U.S. administration also pumped through the media pretexts, such as that the people of Iraq needed to be liberated from their ruthless dictator, and it was high time to allow democracy to flourish throughout the land. People have been writing about war crimes for millennia, long before the establishment of the United Nations and the ICC, International Criminal Court. The framework proffered in 1945 UN Charter derives from the classical just war tradition. By definition, a war criminal is someone who commits war crimes. But according to just war theory, there are two ways to become an unjust warrior. One is to wage an unjust war. The other is to conduct a war unjustly. These two forms of injustice are outlined in the Ad bellum and jus in bello, requirements on a just war, the interpretive fluidity of which has often been seized upon by political leaders intent on waging war. Such leaders use just war theory opportunistically as a template in developing pro-war propaganda. The aim of the drafters of the UN Charter was to rein in such bellicose tendencies and thereby avert tragic and massively destructive conflicts such as the First and Second World Wars by requiring explicit and intersubjective agreement among nations before a war could be waged. Deception is a form of coercion, which implies that a leader who offers false pretext to secure the approval of the UN Security Council, as did George H.W. Bush in 1991, is no less a criminal than a leader whose war objectively violates the written letter of the law, as in the case of his son, George W. Bush's 2003 invasion of Iraq. Indeed, in predicting how leaders will conduct themselves during the prosecution of war, there may be no dependable indicator than how they went about garnering support for it. By now, it is common knowledge that all of the proffered pretexts for the 2003 invasion of Iraq were bogus, from the non-existent WMDs to the alleged collaboration between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. Given the many lies used to persuade politicians and pundits to support the invasion, no one should have been surprised when those who waged a criminal war proceeded to render and torture suspects, kill civilians at checkpoints, deploy white phosphorus and depleted uranium-tipped missiles, raise entire cities, and terrorize civilians with lethal drones. Biden's debilitated mental state and inability to keep his story straight is the perfect metaphor for the attitude of Americans toward war criminals. They blithely ignore or brush aside the crimes committed by their own leaders, while supporting policies which will intensify rather than resolve conflicts abroad.
There is endless lamenting and an anxiety these days about plastic pollution and how to control it. You would think it was a new problem, but of course, along with all forms of pollution, the plastic waste challenge has been with us for a long time. But it was in the 70s that the environmentalist entrepreneur Doe Rossi noticed a business opportunity out of this situation and made a pledge to do something about it for future generations. What did he do? He created the so-called Pollywood by using recycled plastic and wood.
Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of Bozor. In this show, we will look at the wood plastic composite sector and its developing markets in Iran. Nowadays, products of this relatively new sector are all around us and rapidly expanding into new varieties and applications. In this program, we will discover how the never-ending expansion of Pollywood world is facilitating a shift towards a more sustainable environment and explore its role in economic growth.
As a response to sustainability trends and the need to preserve forests and prevent the destruction of the precious resources, we are witnessing the growing expansion of the plastic wood industry in the world. Accordingly, Pollywood has been in Iranian markets for a couple of decades now. One of the leading manufacturers of this green product is a company that uses Decowood as its brand name in Iran. With significant investment and up-to-date technical knowledge, this company has been able to produce different types of plastic wood profiles in various applications by making about 40 types of molds, which gives designers and architects more freedom in their designs. Wood polymer composites are a relatively new product. The current market of 220,000 tons per year has been developed over about 20 years of intense activity. In fact, according to some experts, the product can trace its roots to much earlier, with GOR producing Woodstock for Fiat cars in 1972, and subsequently Sonesson AB producing PVC wood fiber floor tiles in Sweden in 1973. Since then, various research activities took place over the decades before the sector gained momentum in the 1990s, seeing 4 times growth between 1997 and 2000. The new momentum was provided by the dual purpose of replacing petrochemical materials with bio-derived sustainable materials and the need to reduce waste disposal by utilizing new recycling technologies. In this process, WPC was selected as a product into which waste paper or post-consumer plastics, such as used milk jugs, could be recycled.
According to a consumer attitude research, the most common reason for the acceptance of wood plastic composites by Iranian consumers include its moisture resistance properties and the fact that it can replace a variety of wood products due to its durability and plasticity. However, its high price compared with compact wood panels has been monitored as a concern.
The main vision of the founders of DecoWood Company has been to raise public awareness about this industry and its special benefits in environmental issues and protection of wood resources in the country. Therefore, with the intent to spread this important issue at the national level, the founders of this company have concentrated their investment activities in this industry and pride themselves on having produced and delivered high-quality products with wide variety of decorative and utilitarian applications. Because wood plastic composite starts as a paste, it can be molded to almost any shape and size, including arched or bent shapes. That innate flexibility extends to color as well, as it can be dyed or colored to fit almost any project design. Depending on if polyethylene or polypropylene the sawdust is mixed with, WPC can be used for a variety of construction projects in much the same way as natural lumber. Drilling, planning, sanding, it's all done just as easily with WPC. Some construction professionals believe that wood fasteners, like nails and screws, actually achieve a better hold in WPC as compared to normal wood, and WPC is likely to split or break when screws are used near the end of the planks, which can be a common problem when using real wood.
The company we just mentioned represents only a part of a vibrant market in Iran, encompassing many other companies that take advantage of this environmentally friendly product. Together, they produce a wide range of building and decorative materials that have been used in private homes, hotels, offices, hospitals, commercial, and recreational settings.
The array of manufactured products by the Iranian businesses include flooring and deck profiles, wall coverings, partitions, wall panels, rails and doors, and did we mention outdoor furniture? In fact, if you are planning to start a new construction project in the near future, then you should consider these new products that are surprising people all over the world. Most of the interest in many countries is concentrating on the durability and extended service life of WPC due to its large applications in outdoor use. Also, one of the greatest advantages of WPC products is their low maintenance cost as compared to that of solid wood. According to experts, WPC material has a production cost of about 15% more as compared to that of normal lumber, but requires a lower maintenance cost. The actual payback period is estimated at 3 to 5 years compared to pressure-treated decking material. What is most remarkable is the fact that used WPC can be recycled to create brand new WPC, making it the ultimate recyclable commodity.
Wood plastic composites are capable of achieving a huge range of characteristics while always keeping one thing in common, which is sustainability. As consumer attitudes towards our responsibility to the planet are changing, smarter materials offer a way forward.
Wood plastic composites, in fact, display an incredibly wide range of potential applications. by adjusting the species, size, and concentration of wood particles in the formulation, different outcome can be achieved. Wood plastic composites can even be foamed to make a strong lightweight material. Similarly, the chosen wood species will also have an impact on the final product's color. Pine fillers tend to produce products that are lighter in color compared to hardwood fillers. This available range in the look and feel of products made from wood plastic composites offers a wide range of designer preferences. So far, product applications have included children's toys, automotive interiors, patio furniture, garden edging, and more. Furthermore, R&D products using biopolymers or biodegradable polymers have also been launched. These may be competitive either in the market for green consumerism, where 100% bio-derived product is well accepted, or in the market for disposable plastic items, as the search for an easily biodegradable product and the development of a waste industry capable of handling it continues. Iran is associated with many things. If you are into geology, that would be oil oozing out of the land. Iran is among the world's top five in oil reserves. But oil or petroleum is not the only mineral resource that makes the country rich. Copper is among its other riches, as are lead and zinc.
In case you didn't know, Iran has over 220 million tons of proven zinc and lead ore reserves. That is significant. But in copper, it has stood among the top 10. What is being done about all that treasure? It can't all stay underground forever. And there are those extracting and producing the minerals. To meet some of them, we made a trek to Zadin Industrial and Mining Group.
In 2009, Iran produced 383,000 tons of copper, meaning it had the world's ninth largest reserves of copper at 32.5 million tons. As a matter of fact, the mines at Sarcheshme in Kerman province contain the world's second largest load of copper ore, that is 5% of the world's total in 2009. Iran is one of the most important mineral producers in the world, ranking among 15 major mineral-rich countries. It was estimated to hold some 68 types of minerals, 37 billion tons of proven reserves, and more than 57 billion tons of potential reserves worth $770 billion in 2014.
That is not to say mining in Iran has no more work to be done on it. It is still under development, but there are plenty of doers in this country, and plenty more are waiting for further opportunity to arise for their turn at investment. Zarin Group has already arrived at a point to claim we have done what we could.
Flotation, or in other words, ore dressing in mineral processing, is a main process of production. It is a method used to separate and concentrate ores by altering their surfaces to a hydrophobic or hydrophilic condition. These chemical and physical changes to the surface of minerals are made using materials with different properties, including activators.
Now, in working with minerals, the production process is most efficiently carried out in stages. And what a company just cannot do without is its laboratory for pilot tests before going head in with its whole stock. It is literally to avoid the proverbial haste that makes waste.
An asset to corporations is their R&D departments. The reason is they perform research for technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones, hence elevating the company's industrial standing.
The corporation's labor paid off. Zadin has registered or patented 26 inventions, five of which are already industrialized and are being used in the production line. Indeed, standard is everything, especially for foreign trade. And Iran's production, by far outweighing its domestic use, there is plenty of room for mineral exports from this country. The industry is export-oriented, as a matter of fact.
Only 80 to 100,000 tons of produced zinc ingots and 50 to 80,000 tons of lead ingots are consumed domestically. and the remaining were exported to target markets in Asia and Europe, going by 2014 and 2015 estimates. The National Iranian Copper Industries Company is one of the largest companies listed on the Tehran Stock Exchange. It was the largest non-oil exporter in Iran in 2010, with exports worth $1.3 billion. Considered to be the biggest sector in the world in terms of dollar value, the oil and gas sector is a global powerhouse. It uses hundreds of thousands of workers worldwide and generates hundreds of billions of dollars globally each year. The largest volume of products coming out of the oil and gas industry are fuel oil and gasoline. Oil has been used as fuel for transport to generate electricity that lights homes and run factories and machines. And petroleum is the primary material for numerous chemical products, including pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, solvents, and of course, plastics. Our lives would be very different without oil.
This time, we're going to explore technology and engineering related to the oil and gas industry. We wanted to see who the major players in this field are and why their services are so complex and unique.
Our journey took us to a knowledge-based engineering company called Farazan Saze Darya, which began its work over a decade ago. Its main activity is to design and build structures related to oil and gas extraction and transfer. It has a broad scope of engineering services. The things it designs encompass onshore and offshore oil platforms, storage tankers, distribution pipelines, and other structures and buildings related to the oil and gas industry. Just like the structure or facility, oil infrastructure is also susceptible to earthquake damage, particularly in southern Iran, where tremors are more common. This firm was among the first engineering companies to implement the new government standards for earthquake-proofing oil platforms and rigs both in and offland. This company has a long portfolio of projects it has engineered over the years. One such project was to create oil tankers and pumps for the strategic Jask oil project. This is a project that transfers oil through a 1,000-kilometer pipeline along the southern coast to the Jask oil terminal. It is predicted that after completion, this project will have the capacity to transfer up to 1 million barrels of crude per day. However, that's only one of the projects that this company has completed, and there are dozens more.
Previously, such services were imported into the country. This means that when a new oil platform was needed or an old one needed maintenance, industry participants had to employ foreign companies to come to Iran and get the job done. Among other complications, this process was expensive and created a dependency on foreign services.
One of the major advantages of this company is it has localized this specialized engineering service in the country. Indigenizing and employing domestic know-how in the oil industry has helped the country save millions over the years. This company has developed such that now it exports its engineering services. It also collaborates with foreign firms to build and design structures. This firm has created hundreds of employment opportunities, particularly in specialized field of engineering in the gas and oil sector. It has also indirectly generated numerous jobs through subcontractors and construction execution. It is no surprise that this knowledge-based firm has gathered some of the most experienced experts in the industry at its facilities. Among its many activities, it also cooperates with numerous universities and academic institutions. Such steps are necessary for this company to stay up to date. Plus, it incorporates and applies cutting-edge technology in the design and implementation of its projects. This company adheres to strict international standards for designing and building its structures. With years of experience and numerous foreign contracts under its belt, this company has been able to expand its know-how for executing projects with the highest quality.
Here's a fun fact you might not have known. With rich oil reserves, Iran is one of the founding members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC. Based on figures from OPEC, the country is the fourth largest oil producer among its members. Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world.
Iran's oil sector will be the first to benefit from